On the program this Wednesday, not so much the news of today, more like the news of our global near-term economic future. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the ninth day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We started out this morning thinking that after 2 weeks of war and Western sanctions and all the twists and turns of the economic response to the invasion, it might be time for a recap. Which sanctions on which company? What's been cut off and what hasn't? Where the commodities story happens to be and what's left for the West to go after? So we made some calls, reported it out, and it became pretty clear that a better use of our time might be to talk about the guy who's ultimately going to decide what happens and what Vladimir Putin's economic future looks like. So we got Chris Miller on the phone. He's the co-director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Professor Miller, welcome to the program. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So given all that by way of setup, what do you imagine Vladimir Putin's economic policy thoughts are right now?
Well, the Russian leadership is in a real dilemma. They've got a set of financial sanctions that they weren't prepared for and is imposing costs that they'll struggle to deal with. There's two key issues that they face. One is trying to make sure the financial system stays stable and they don't have banking issues or financial markets freezing up domestically. And the second is trying to address the fall in living standards that's going to be caused as prices go up and inflation jumps.
Yeah, so that second thing, how does he do that with central bank and foreign reserves that are frozen, a currency that's fundamentally worthless, dropped by 50%, let's say, a stock market that has not opened, and as soon as it does, it will not be pretty. How does he take care of the Russian populace?
Well, the Russian government is still trying to keep the ruble from falling further, and it does have some resources to do that with. It's not easy, but its ability to do this isn't indefinite because the resources are limited. And so at some point, the Russian government has to simply recognize that living standards are going to fall.
Do you think, so Russia has spent the last, 30-something years making really solid inroads to being a market economy. Do you think that can continue after this country, which is, not a small economy, right? It's number like 11 or something in the world, after it's fundamentally cut off from a huge chunk of the global economy?
Well, the problem that the market economy in Russia faces right now is that a lot of private businesses are essentially being squeezed off from any financing, in many cases squeezed off from their markets. And what's going to remain is largely the state-owned part of the economy. It'll benefit from government support, and also the state-owned part of the economy is in industries that were, generally speaking, less reliant on foreign connections or are in spheres like energy where there's still a fair amount of foreign trade that's possible. It's the rest of the economy that really faced the most difficult outlook over the coming months.
Quantify that for me, would you? I mean, a difficult outlook over the coming months seems a little sterile, right? It will not be pretty over there.
Well, it won't be pretty. It's really difficult to forecast with any sort of certainty as to how bad it's going to be, in part because we haven't had sanctions like this on a major economy in three quarters of a century. So we're operating in really new territory. And the Russian policymaking elite doesn't know how to deal with it. They're right now improvising for a crisis that they weren't ready to face.
Do you suppose we're headed back to the and look, this is too far a jump, but to the Soviet-ish era days of a command economy over there?
I think that is a reasonable comparison to make. The government's taking more and more direct control of business decisions. It's imposing new restrictions on the flow of capital and on ability of individuals to access their own bank accounts. I think the other factor that matters on this front is that the Russian economy is going to get more militarized as the government tries to prepare itself for the current war and any future confrontations. And the more the military and the security services play a role in economic policy, the more command methods come to the fore.
Chris Miller, he's at the Fletcher School at Tufts. Professor Miller, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thanks for having me.
The only command on Wall Street today was to buy everything except oil. Lots of selling there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The world uses, give or take, 100 million barrels of oil a day. The world produces, give or take, 100 million barrels of oil a day. It's a pretty delicate balance, and it doesn't take much of an imbalance to seriously affect the price. See also cutting off Russia, or even the threat of cutting off Russia. The easy answer when prices go up is to just pump more. That is, however, as we all know, a delicate geopolitical and environmental dance. And yes, the United States could produce more by itself. Not enough to completely fill the gap, mind you, but some. The thing is, even if we decided today we were going to start drilling, it'd be a good long while before any of that oil made its way out of the ground and into a refinery. Just how long a while? Andy Euler is our energy guy.
It's natural to look at a gas pump that reads $4 a gallon or more and wonder why oil companies based in the United States aren't putting more oil onto the market. One, to take advantage of these higher prices, and two, to help out American consumers.
The problem is, and the harsh reality for U.S. oil markets, is that there is no switch that anyone can flip to suddenly turn on oil production overnight. There just isn't.
That's Clark Williams Derry. He's an analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
There is probably going to be a 6 to 9 month lag between today's high prices and the time when the oil industry can bring significant amounts of new production online.
Now, some drillers are already ramping up in the Permian Basin of West Texas and the Bakken Shale of North Dakota. Those are mostly privately owned companies chasing profits now. But public companies and their investors have been burned in the past by what people in the industry call irrational exuberance, and they're moving a lot slower. Michael Lynch is a fellow at the Energy Policy Research Foundation.
If you have started to talk about spending more like 20%, but they're still feeling pressure from the capital markets and so forth to not go hog wild as they have a tendency to do historically.
And when it comes to major oil companies, the multinationals, they're not limited to increasing production in West Texas or the Dakotas. They have lots of other cheaper options. Fracking shale wells is more expensive than getting oil out of conventional ones. Francis O'Sullivan is an adjunct professor at MIT's Sloan School of Business. He says they have higher input costs, require more work and equipment to get the oil moving.
So even though it has the capacity to ramp up production quickly, it's important to recognize that that's certainly not a low-cost source of new production.
O'Sullivan says high oil prices are both a blessing and a curse for companies trying to get crude out of the ground. Sure, they're able to charge more for a produced barrel, but their service providers can also charge more for their labor. That is, if there's any available.
You know what's going to happen with the price of oil going through the roof. Equipment's going to be hard to find. Crews are going to be hard to find.
Paul Baumer is a senior lecturer in the Department of Petroleum Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin.
You might have 100 wells you'd like to complete, but you can't get the equipment and the people to complete them.
And Baumer says that's only going to increase the amount of time between the drill bit hitting the dirt and the first gallon flowing into your tank. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A quick economic vocabulary primer here by way of setting up Matt Levin and this next story. We're talking gas prices, which, in case you somehow have missed it, sit today at $4.25 on the national average. That is today's money. Nominal dollars is what economists say. And you have surely heard that is higher than the previous record set in 2008 of $4.16 a gallon, which it is. But what we need to do to compare the two is talk about real dollars, dollars adjusted for inflation. And that 2008 gallon of gas in 2022 real dollars would be $5.25. Now, does that make you feel better? No, of course not, Guy. Come on, and I get that. But now at least you know. Also, not feeling very good about gas prices, by the way, are politicians. Governors from New Mexico to Michigan want Congress to suspend the federal gas tax, and blue and red states both are looking to easing their own state gas taxes. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains whether that would really make a difference at that pump.
The federal gas tax hasn't increased since 1993. No matter where you live, it's 18 cents a gallon. Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center says suspending the tax wouldn't save drivers all that much money.
Do the math. It's about $100 a year in savings, or about 30 cents a day.
And that's assuming all those savings would get passed on to consumers.
What's more likely to happen is that oil companies will simply keep some of the tax cut themselves.
A gas tax holiday proposed by some congressional Democrats tries to curb oil company windfalls, but Gleckman is skeptical it's actually enforceable. And while savings at the pump may be relatively small, you could drive a Hummer through the hole it would leave in the federal infrastructure budget. Robert Puentes is president of the Eno Center for Transportation.
It would be about a $20 billion hit on the transportation trust fund.
That's the main source of money for fixing roads, bridges, and subways. And Puentes says a gas tax holiday for the rest of the year would cut it in half. And there's a bigger question. Do we really want gas to be cheaper?
As we're trying to build cleaner vehicles, cleaner infrastructure, the gasoline tax on the federal and state levels is a big component of that.
But those state gas taxes can be sizable. In California and New York, it's about 50 cents a gallon. Adi Tomer with the Brookings Institution says it's important to remember gas taxes are regressive, hitting poorer households more than richer ones. In his mind, a holiday could help those who need it most.
What we expect is to see lower income households have a little bit more scratch in their budget during a time of real inflationary pressure.
Tomer says infrastructure funding could come from other sources besides the pump. As cars have been more fuel efficient, gas tax revenue has been flatlining anyway. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Okay, you might remember we talked about the flight to safety the other day. People were buying U.S. government bonds because they are safe as the shock of the war in Ukraine started to really sink in. The way bonds work is that the more people buy them, the lower the yield, the interest rate that they pay. And that flight to safety has started showing up now in the housing market. Mortgage rates fell last week for the first time in about 3 months. The Mortgage Bankers Association says average interest on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage dropped to 4.09%, 4.15% the week before. That's great if you can lock in your rate, say, now. But with the war still happening and the Fed meeting next week and inflation and everything, there is a whole lot of uncertainty about where rates are headed as the spring home buying season gets underway. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
This may well be a temporary dip in mortgage rates, because you know what's coming next week. Danielle Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com, says Fed leaders are still expected to raise interest rates at their March meeting to try to curb inflation.
While they acknowledge there's a lot of uncertainty in the economy stemming from the conflict in Europe, they still see the need to tighten. And so that means we're likely to see mortgage rates begin to tick up again.
In the short term, she says that could actually spur home sales as buyers rush to lock in what are still very low rates before they rise further. But longer term,
affordability is going to be very top of mind for folks, especially in an inflationary environment like we're in right now.
There are signs inflation is already weighing on buyers' minds. Tawanda Burney is a broker in Charlotte, North Carolina, who also has a loan signing business.
Within the last 2 weeks with gas prices, I've been getting a lot of people concerned about that and thinking about, you know, stepping back to see where everything's going.
Those prices are hurting her business in another way.
I've got a vehicle that takes premium gas and I don't want to go out and show anything.
What hasn't changed is the lack of homes for sale. Listings typically pick up during the spring and summer months, but Ann Powell at Coldwell Banker in Ocean View, Delaware, doesn't think it'll be enough to put a damper on prices. Most of her clients are wealthy people buying second and even third homes, and she doesn't expect them to be too phased by higher mortgage rates.
And these second home buyers either just, you know, life is short, let's go get the beach house. We can't wait till tomorrow anymore because look what tomorrow brings. And now I think also people are saying, hey, it might be a good idea to diversify our holdings and let's put something in real estate.
Making it that much harder for people just trying to buy their first house. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I remember one time when the price of limes shot up.
Oh, I hate it when that happens. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 653 today. That's 2%, 33,286. The NASDAQ added 459 points, about 3.6%, finished at 13,255. The S&P 500 up 107 points, 2.5%, 42.77. Netflix up 5% on an upgrade from Wedbush. The investment firm cited Netflix's big subscriber base and said that that gave the streamer a nearly insurmountable competitive advantage over its streaming peers, of which Amazon added 2.4%. Today, Disney gained 1.4%. Oil talked about that. The global benchmark, Brent North Sea crude, $112.94 a barrel at the close. That is down just about 12%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.93%. Today, clearly, people not worried about risk anywhere. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Russian war on Ukraine has prompted a whole lot of giving. Giving to aid groups and NGOs, giving to individual Ukrainians, remittances. We talked about that the other day. And giving to the fight against Russia, the actual conduct of the war itself. Just yesterday, the Ukrainian government raised more than $250 million in war bond sales. But more often than not, as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, getting that money into the right hands can be a challenge.
As Russia rolled into Ukraine, the Ukrainian government asked the world for help. And people here in San Francisco's main Ukrainian neighborhood heeded that call.
I tried to send money to special account to raise funds for Ukrainian armed force.
You want to support the effort?
Yes, I want to support Ukrainian armed force.
But Alex Solivniak was stuck.
And you haven't been able to do that?
No. I want to send yesterday $5,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how did you try to do that?
I'm going to Chase Bank and show that account number from government. But that's not work.
The Ukrainian government has been sharing its bank account information for weeks on social media and on television. But international money transfers can be tricky. Solivniak called up a friend, Igor Shurikov, who had some advice.
So people say it's a little bit easier with Wells Fargo, and whatever is shown on the Ukrainian television, they show those routing numbers, the account numbers. The Bank of America doesn't support that. It also requires the SWIFT code and so on.
Helping individuals put up money to defend against an invasion isn't something most major U.S. banks have experience with. And SWIFT, the messaging technology involved in sending these kinds of wire transfers, and from which Russia has been banned, can be pretty clunky.
It's a system that was designed 50 years ago and just has a lot of limitations to it.
Lisa Ellis is a partner at equity research firm Moffitt Nathanson.
The primary issue most likely occurring in this case is an issue of just account verification.
In other words, a legal requirement that banks have to make sure the money is actually going to the Ukrainian government and that it isn't being used for anything illegal.
It's put in place to restrict the ability of criminal enterprises to move money.
Ukraine is also accepting cryptocurrency, says Lee Reiners at Duke University's law school.
To my knowledge, this is the first time you sort of seen an active crowdfund campaign conducted by a nation state principally to receive cryptocurrencies.
Reiners says there are pros and cons.
Crypto is easier to send across borders without the need for any know your customer checks or any of that stuff. So I can see the appeal on both sides, but there's just a lot of risk involved.
For example, a fraudster could pose as the Ukrainian government. Reiner says for people who want to support Ukraine, donating to humanitarian organizations is a safer bet. He says it's best to leave funding Ukraine's army to other nation states. In San Francisco, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Okay, let's do a little tomorrow's news today, shall we? The item that is going to get all the non-war headlines in the morning is the February Consumer Price Index, which you don't even have to be a regular listener to this program to know is inflation at the consumer level. 7.5% annually in January. February might probably going to be higher, but what we want to go over real quick today is how we talk about inflation and why. There are two numbers to look at, the headline number, of course, which is all prices, and then core inflation, which in January was a lower but still high 6% annually, of course. The difference is that core inflation doesn't include food and energy prices, which, given that we all use a whole lot of food and energy, why don't we count it again?
Most economists agree it began in the early 1970s, during a time when there was a sharp increase in energy prices.
Kevin Gleason's an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and the BLS has been measuring the Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers, all items less food and energy. That's core inflation in the very formal manner. They've been measuring that since 1957. But Gleason says the 1970s were when economists started paying extra attention to the core. One of the defining images of that period, of course, is cars lined up at gas stations during the OPEC oil embargo. From 1973 to 1974, the average price of a gallon of gas rose 46%, causing, of course, headline inflation to go up a lot.
Some economists got the bright idea that, well, let's just strip out these prices that are rising the fastest and the mostest and then see what happens. And voila, the core measures showed that inflation was much lower than the headline.
There haven't been all that many periods of high inflation since the 1970s, but that whole headline and core split in the CPI still lingers. Erica Groshen was commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2013 to 2017. She's at Cornell now.
When I was at BLS, I would get a briefing the day before the inflation numbers came out, where they walked me through everything that was in them.
Everything in the Consumer Price Index, cell phone bills, airfares.
I remember one time when the price of limes shot up, and it was like $1.50 per lime, you know. $2 per lime, and this had to do with a blight down in Mexico.
One thing like that blight or bad weather can move food prices a lot in a single month, so the core strips them out to manage that volatility.
If you're looking at it from a monetary policy standpoint, core inflation is going to be what you want to be following.
And who is looking at it from a monetary policy standpoint? Yes. The Federal Reserve, when they are making decisions about interest rates. And as, again, even non-regular listeners know, food and energy are some of the biggest factors in inflation right now.
Well, this is where the debate starts to get interesting.
That's Gleason from the St. Louis Fed again. The debate he is talking about is which inflation number you ought to focus on more. For him personally, it's headline.
If you ask people, you know, is inflation going up or going down? And they'll say, well, let's see, it costs me more to fill up my gas tank, and it cost me a lot more the last time I went to the grocery store.
The February Consumer Price Index comes out tomorrow, measured, we should note, before this latest spike in gas prices. And it doesn't seem to me to be out of bounds to wonder whether this might be another inflation inflection point, like the 1970s was, that changed how we talk about inflation. This final note on the way out today, tip of the hat to Olivier Knox at the Washington Post, who came upon some data from Castellum AI. They track economic sanctions and regulations. Anyway, they say Russia is now the most sanctioned country in the world. 5,532 separate sanctions against them. Number two, anybody? Come on. It's not that hard. Iran, 3,616 sanctions on them. All right, we're done. Here is your moment of economic context. The obligatory caveat here is that the stock market, say it with me now, is not the economy, but history is cool, so I'm going to tell you this. Today, 13 years ago, March the 9th of 2009, was the stock market low after the financial crisis. S&P was at 750-something. The Dow was at 7,800. Look at them now. Also, consult your own financial advisor, but buy and hold, people, buy and hold. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.